Imagine staging a silent protest by physically guarding the executed bodies of your children.
Oh man, yeah, just the thought of that is intense.
Right, like fighting off wild animals day and night for months. And doing all this just to force a king to admit he was wrong and grant them a proper burial.
It is so raw. I mean, it completely shatters the illusion we often have about historical leadership manuals, you know?
Absolutely. We always expect these glossy, sanitized brochures with flawless heroes.
Right. But the reality of how people actually survive and lead in ancient times is just, well, it's gritty, it's deeply flawed, and heavily dependent on taking extreme measures when the systems completely fail.
For sure. So, welcome to another custom-tailored exploration into our source material. Today, we're diving into a comprehensive PDF text for you titled Her Story, His Glory.
Lessons from Biblical Women for Today.
Exactly. It's written by Dr. Samuel D. Stevens, who is the founder of Women with a Mission India.
And our objective today is to really dig into this document, right? It was originally designed for women leaders in a specific spiritual community.
Yeah, to extract modern lessons on leadership, courage, and justice from ancient texts.
And just to establish the framework before we get too deep, the text contains 31 distinct reflections.
Which is a lot to cover in one go.
It is, yeah. So we've distilled those insights into four evolutionary stages of human resilience. We're really focusing on how the author uses these ancient figures to address the very modern structural and personal struggles you might face today.
But before we jump in, just a quick disclaimer. As your guides, we are not taking theological sides here or endorsing the specific religious viewpoints of the text.
Right, we're totally neutral on that front.
Our mission is just to impartially extract the fascinating psychological and historical patterns the author presents. So, okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
Starting with the foundation. I notice the author doesn't begin his lessons with queens or diplomats. He actually starts with outcasts.
Yeah, he identifies that before anyone can wield structural power, they first have to fight to establish their own basic value within oppressive systems.
Which makes sense.
It does. The text focuses heavily on Hagar and Leah to start. So Hagar is an Egyptian maidservant forced into a surrogate role, and then she's just cast out into a deadly desert.
Just completely discarded.
Exactly. Yet the author highlights her as the one who actually names the divine. She calls God El Roy.
Which translates to the God who sees.
Yes. And then we have Leah. She's the unloved first wife of Jacob who spends years, I mean, literally years, trying to win her husband's affection by bearing children.
It's just a heartbreaking cycle.
It is. But eventually, the text shows her finally shifting her focus to find worth outside of human validation entirely. What's fascinating here is the psychological mechanism the author is highlighting.
Okay, I have to push back here, though.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Look at Hagar and Leah. I mean, they were essentially treated as property in this ancient context.
Right, they were.
Isn't it a bit problematic to frame their survival as an empowerment lesson? Like, to a modern ear, this sounds like just learning to cope with severe oppression rather than actually leading.
I completely see why you'd say that. But he is writing for modern readers who often feel entirely overlooked or trapped in toxic family and professional dynamics themselves.
So it's more about where the power starts.
Exactly. By starting with figures who are legally and socially powerless, the text argues that empowerment cannot wait for the system to become fair. It has to start internally.
I see.
The moment Leah stops seeking her worth through a broken patriarchal marriage is the exact moment she actually gains agency.
Oh, wow. It's almost like the ultimate rejection of our modern visibility culture, you know?
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Because we exhaust ourselves chasing social media likes or like corporate recognition. We're so desperate to be seen by the system.
Right. We want the system to validate us.
Exactly. When the real shift happens, when you just validate yourself, and that internal shift sets the stage for what happens next, which is once you recognize your own value, how do you respond to the systemic injustice around you?
And here's where it gets really interesting. The actions these women take are shockingly subversive.
You really are.
Dr. Stevens deliberately focuses on controversial figures who take extreme measures when society completely fails them.
Like Tamar.
Yes, take Tamar. In this ancient society, a widow without children had zero economic or legal protection, like none.
She was totally vulnerable.
Right. Her father-in-law, Judah, was legally obligated by Levirate law to provide her a new husband from his lineage to protect her status.
But he refuses.
He absolutely refused. So Tamar disguised herself and tricked Judah into sleeping with her. She effectively weaponized the very patriarchal laws designed to control her.
Just to secure her own survival and her rightful place in the lineage.
Exactly. She used the system against itself.
That is wild. And then you have Joiel, a civilian, who ends up driving a tent peg through the skull of the enemy general Sisera.
It's so visceral.
It is. And of course, Rizpah, mother we mentioned at the start, engaging in that harrowing, months-long physical protest over her executed sons.
It's a lot of intense action.
So how does the author reconcile these deeply controversial, sometimes violent acts with practical moral lessons for the listener today?
Well, the underlying premise is that when established legal or social systems are deeply unjust, finding justice requires stepping drastically outside of polite societal norms.
So you can't just follow the rules if the rules are meant to crush you.
Precisely. The text uses these extreme historical examples to demonstrate that advocating for yourself or your family isn't about asking nicely.
Right.
Sometimes it requires you to be a highly disruptive force.
Yeah, but you can't just be a disruptive force forever. I mean, Tamar and Jehiel are great for tearing down broken systems, but to build a new one, you need institutions.
You need structure.
You need collaboration. Mm-hmm. And that brings us to the next phase, the women who operated as recognized community pillars.
Yeah, we see a clear progression in the text toward women wielding recognized structural authority.
Like Deborah.
Yes, Deborah is a judge and a prophetess, but the author really highlights her necessity for partnership. She's working directly alongside a military commander named Barak to secure a national victory.
It's all about teamwork there.
Exactly. We also see Priscilla, an early Christian missionary who acts as a spiritual leader and teacher.
And she notably instructs Apollos, right? Who is this highly educated and prominent man.
She does. And then we have Phoebe and Syntyche. The author commends Phoebe as a deaconess and a financial benefactor of the early church.
And Syntyche is highlighted for her active collaboration in spreading the gospel.
Right, with the author really stressing the critical need for unity over personal disagreements.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? Because if we look at Phoebe through a modern lens, she wasn't just a benefactor writing a polite charity check.
Oh, definitely not.
She was essentially an angel investor in a highly illegal, high-risk startup.
That is such a brilliant analogy.
She was deploying capital into an underground movement that could have easily gotten her killed.
Yeah, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the author is establishing a historical precedent for women holding structural power, driving community missions, and taking massive strategic risks.
They weren't just playing it safe.
No, they understood how to leverage resources and influence to build something larger than themselves, all in an environment that was actively hostile to their existence.
But just when you think we've arrived at this pristine model of structural leadership, the text throws a massive curveball.
It really does.
Because the narrative brings us full circle by examining the sheer messiness of humanity. Even these monumental leaders make catastrophic, relationship-destroying mistakes.
Yeah, the author doesn't shy away from the collateral damage at all.
Let's talk about Sarah.
Well, Sarah's impatience with timing leads her to offer Hagar to her husband, injecting intense generational strife into her family.
And Rebecca.
Rebecca exhibits blatant favoritism and orchestrates a massive deception that fractures her family dynamics for generations as well.
And then there's Bathsheba.
Right. Bathsheba is caught in a tragic web involving the misuse of power and sin with King David, yet her story ultimately leads to the birth of King Solomon.
So the ultimate insight here isn't just a generic, you know, nobody is perfect kind of thing.
No, it goes deeper.
It's that in ancient history, the people who actually moved the needle were often the ones who caused the most collateral damage.
Yeah, it's messy.
We are essentially reading a leadership manual that suggests true structural change requires a level of messiness that modern PR teams would never, ever allow.
That's entirely true. The author's thesis is that God's sovereignty and redemptive plans transcend human limitations.
So it takes the pressure off.
Exactly. By highlighting these massive flaws, the text relieves the reader of the burden of perfection. It argues that your human failures or your family dysfunction cannot thwart broader historical or divine purposes.
Which is pretty profound.
And while this text is steeped in specific theological beliefs, the psychological and sociological patterns of these women fighting for agency are universally fascinating.
Totally. So just to briefly recap this journey for everyone listening, we've moved from marginalized figures finding their internal worth.
To rebels taking gritty action to force justice.
Right. And then to institutional leaders building communities through massive risk.
And finally, to the realization that perfection just isn't required to shape history.
It's a huge arc.
It really is. And just as a quick impartiality reminder, while we're exploring these heavily theological stories, the human element, how people advocate for themselves, is something everyone can analyze. This raises an important question about how we view the tools of advocacy throughout history.
It really does, because these stories highlight women navigating highly restrictive societies using the only subversive tools available to them at the time.
Whether that was deception or a silent physical protest or leveraging their finances in underground movements.
Exactly. It makes you wonder, if we look at how marginalized groups advocate for themselves today, how will future generations judge the methods we are forced to use right now to shape our own history?
That is something to think about.
Definitely. Well, thank you for joining us for this custom exploration. We'll catch you next time.